Cambridge 105 Radio.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women. We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results.
I'm Linda Ness.
And I'm Susie Thorpe.
And we produce and present Women Making Waves. In this edition of Women Making Waves, we speak to Extinction Rebellion spokesperson Zeon Lights, who is a passionate science communicator interested in everything from Earth to the stars. Zeon was named as Britain's greenest mother in 2015 by the Daily Telegraph and an eco-pragmatist, happily heavy on evidence, by The Guardian.
And Anya Nowitzki is the founding partner at Vule Capital, Europe's first venture capital fund for female founders. Anya is an investor in residence at Google for Startups, the winner of the Women in Finance Specialist Investor of the Year 2019 award, and has been featured in many publications.
That's all coming up in this episode of Women Making Waves. Zeon Lights is a spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion UK. Zeon is an activist, British author, and known for her environmental work and science communication. She has written for the Huffington Post, is author of the book The Ultimate Guide to Green Parenting, and is a TEDx speaker. Zeon recently became editor-in-chief for The Hourglass magazine, a newspaper that aims to tell the truth about climate and ecological emergency.
A lot of us are putting our liberty on the line when we get arrested. You know, what will you put on the line when you really understand that this is like a war-type mobilisation we need?
Zeon Lights is a science communicator and author of The Ultimate Guide to Green Parenting, MSc in Science Communication, and is a TEDx speaker as well, and also, of course, spokesperson for the Extinction Rebellion UK, and also editor of the XR UK newspaper, The Hourglass. Welcome to Women Making Waves. Lovely to have you here on our programme. The first thing I want to ask you really is, you've got so many hats, as I said, on your head that you deal with every day, and you say you spend quite a bit of time coming in on to London to do all your meetings. But where did it all begin? Because I think the one thing that sticks out for me is you are a science communicator. So how did that all begin?
So I get asked this question quite a lot, and it's really difficult to answer it without saying that it began when I was a child, and that it was just there. I was a child, I was trying to get my parents to recycle, I was trying to do all the little eco-warrior things back when, you know, it wasn't something people were doing. They all, you know, my siblings made fun of me, and I learned about global warming at school, I learned about the environment and degradation and landfill sites, and I just thought, this is all wrong, you know. I was basically a little Greta Thunberg, but well before, you know, anybody paid attention to anything like that. And I went vegan when I was 18, you know, really young, really difficult back then. That's why you couldn't get alternative milk anywhere.
So you say, I'm curious because you say at an early age you were quite into eco moments and making sure that everything was biodegradable and we recycled. What did your parents think of that? Because it must have been quite a new thing for them.
Yeah, and actually they humoured me quite a lot. But there were times, I definitely remember times that I went too far. For example, just things like I would take things out of the bin and put them in a separate bin for paper. And then they would say, you know, there was no curbside collection. So I can see in hindsight it was actually making their lives harder. They're both working hard. They've got six children. They're just, you know, why is their daughter causing grief for them? But for me, it was really important. And but after a while, I think they just realised this is just who she is and she's never going to stop. And they humoured me more. But I definitely remember upsetting them a few times.
And what about your school? I mean, obviously,
it was the same there. I mean, I can't remember the names I got called, but it was not a popular thing to be like an eco. It wasn't even that term back then.
Now, that's interesting you say about being unpopular. And at school, it's really important to be popular, or not even that, just to sort of glide through school without anything. So obviously, when you're at school and you had all these really, really fascinating and very important beliefs in how we treat Earth, planet, how hard was it to come away and go through school and move on into university?
Well, actually, I would say university was easier. So when I went from, and then I was in sixth form, and again, people not really caring about the issues and constantly trying to talk to them about it. Then I went to university and suddenly there was a whole group of people who said, we care about this too, you know, and we, you know, one of them I'm still really close friends with today, and that was 16 years ago that I met him. And we joined Amnesty, and we founded the Campaigns Forum, and we founded the Veggie Group, and we did, you know, protests on campus. And again, that was well before, you know, and we got vegan food on the menu in the cafe, things like that, well before anybody was doing it, really. But it was much easier to do it there, and I don't know why. I think maybe the tide sort of had started turning, and people started caring about those issues. And now I'd say it's just super easy. Now you know, it's just a normal thing on the agenda. But your other question about why I went into science communication was because I found that I was talking to people about environmental issues and they didn't care. And I thought, maybe it's the way I'm communicating it. Is there a different way to communicate it? So I went and did a master's and learned what are the best ways to communicate about different issues. You know, is fear a good way? You know, how do you help people if they have that fear, to work through that fear? Or, you know, is it good to shine a positive light? Do people need hope? And actually a lot of it came down to, you know, who are the people and what are the demographics? And, you know, very complicated area, but I definitely learned a lot of things that I wish I'd known really when I was much younger. But now, you know, I've been back to my parents and my siblings, and they all recycle anyway. And they actually, my brother, he's an engineer, a really smart guy, when he showed me his system, he doesn't even use the council system. He's got his own bins that he set up in his house, so that he doesn't have to bring the bins in and out of the house. And then he empties them, and he's got all different colour glass in his kitchen, just pristine setup. And he said when he showed me the first time, look at this, we used to make fun of you for this, I couldn't believe
it. So you could almost say that you inspired your family in many ways, didn't you? Especially your brother. Is your brother older than you or
older,
younger?
Yeah,
he's older than you.
But
even better.
Yeah, maybe, but I think part of it is just everybody's doing it.
Yeah.
But there were certainly a group of us that inspired that change to happen, where it went from being difficult and they didn't want to do it to, oh, it's a curbside thing, so everybody does it, I'm going to do it now. I think that was the shift.
Was it the fear that made you want to get into this whole eco moment and making sure these really important issues were being brought to the mainstream? Was there always a fear when you were younger and then when you were at university? Is that what drove you?
When I was a child, it started as fear, because I remember there was a advertising campaign. I can't remember who it was. It might have been somewhere like Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth. And they showed like people turning off taps and turning off lights, and then they'd have on the screen, it's not too late to act. And I remember watching this advert and my sister sitting there, much older than me, she's about 10 years older, and she said, oh, but it is. And I was just a child, you know, I was like 8 or something, and it really stuck in my head that what if it's too late? And I went through this whole process of what happens if it's too late, you know, and what have we done? What are we doing to the planet? And I have to do something about this. And then, you know, that really drove me. Initially, I wouldn't say I'm fueled by fear now, and I have a lot more acceptance now of what's happening, which I think you do develop after 30 years of watching the same thing happen and things actually getting worse in a lot of areas.
Alarming language, as you say, you have felt the fear then, and today children are on strike on Fridays, climate change strike. Mm. Do you have that fear like the children have that fear now, or is that something different to what you felt?
I would say not so much fear. I feel constant betrayal. I brought children into this world. We knew there was a problem and we actually just let that problem get worse. And I knew there was a problem, but I was doing things, working on it, thinking we're not going to let this get worse. And then that IPCC report came out last year. It's what I looked at in autumn. It's about the time when Greta started striking, Extinction Rebellion came into being, because we all saw the data and went, oh my goodness, it's so much worse than we thought. And all that time they were saying they were doing things, they weren't really doing anything.
So when you say they, who are we talking about here?
Politicians, world leaders, you know, the people who really had, you know, make the decisions of whether they're going to fund fossil fuels or clean energy ventures, those people really let us down. So a lot of the time I feel betrayal, also betrayal that it falls on me and ordinary people like me to have to now talk to people about this and tell them. And it's a horrible thing, honestly. I do so much public speaking.
You have spoken at the TEDx talks. Mm-hmm. Was that your first time you've done that?
Yes.
So as a communicator, science communicator, you've got all this fantastic experience. You're a mum. You know exactly what you want to talk about. Was it a very exciting and also very nerve-wracking moment to be at these TED Talks? Because they go viral, don't they?
Yeah. It's interesting as well with that TED Talk because I got to choose a topic and everybody expected me to talk about climate or environment. And I was so burned out from that. I said, I have to do something that is invigorating and gives me... And actually, you know, if I had done that, it probably would have been really popular and really what people needed to hear, but I needed a break and I said, I'm going to do astronomy because it's a passion and I love it and I think you can have a real connection with nature and the past and all kinds of mythologies when you look at the stars, so that's what I did it on. So doing it as like a passion and not like I'm bringing people a really heavy message actually for me was a bit of a break.
Yeah.
Because it was a nice positive thing that you don't often get to talk about when you talk about the environment. But it is nerve-wracking. It's always nerve-wracking when you do any kind of public speaking. You never know quite what the reception will be, or you never quite know. With that, we at least had a rehearsal. But I remember we had the rehearsal the day before and it all seemed fine. I went up on stage and it was just in front of the TED people. And then the next day, obviously 800 people are queuing to come in and you can see them outside.
800?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And they're all like, you're going on in 10 minutes, get your mic on. And I walked on and I just had this moment because basically when they put the spotlight on you, now I'm sure people in theatre and actors know this, but I didn't know this. When they put the spotlight on you, you can't see anything. It's just dark. So all my friends had come up to support me in the audience and I couldn't see them. And I also was a bit kind of like, where do I look? Am I looking at the stairs, you know? And I had that in the back of my mind. But I'd rehearsed it so much. They teach you, rehearse it so much, you know, be ready with what you want to say. So I was fairly confident, but it was nerve-wracking. I did feel a bit like running off. I didn't know.
Also in the TEDx talks, you say that when you were young, you were so fascinated by the stars and the whole arena up above that you bought yourself a telescope. Mm-hmm. At what age did you do this? I mean, that's amazing.
I can't remember. I was quite young and I didn't really have any help. Also, remember, I grew up in Birmingham. It's so light polluted. I think I was a very ambitious child. but it was much later. I was much older when I was a teenager when I first saw the Milky Way, which actually a lot of people still haven't seen, you know. And that was it. I was hooked. You can never look at it too much. It's just, you can say you've seen the pictures and the purples and the colours, but when you actually look at it and you see stardust, you just think, I want everyone to see this every day. And I think we'd live so differently if we did. And actually, if you think about it, for most of our time on this planet, humankind has been able to see the stars. We used to sleep under them and we used to live very outdoor lifestyles and we didn't have a lot of light pollution. It's very recently that we've lost that connection. I think there might be something in that with kind of losing a overall bigger perspective or philosophical perspective.
Well, actually, there's been a lot of fantastic news about you as well, but one of the quotes is you're an outspoken science advocate. Obviously, we just talk about that. But do you need to be constantly outspoken to really push forward a movement like Extinction Rebellion and all that? Do you have to be so outspoken?
I don't think you have to be, because there are so many people who do work who don't work that way. There's so many people who work really well at Extinction Rebellion, like, you know, a lot of the artists who are actually really quietly working away. You know, for every one of me, there's 100 of them. So there is that. I am very outspoken naturally, so I often get put in these roles.
Just want to also recap one more moment on the TEDx talk that I thought was really, really interesting, is you went across a field and you took your telescope up and you were, quotes, trespassing on some land and the farmer and his son came along.
Yes.
So what happened?
Well, so this is a great story. So it was also in deepest, darkest Devon, which is not, some of these areas are not always known for their friendliness. And it was outside an area called Crediton. There's a lot of farmers around there. And honestly, it looked like it was an open part of land because their fence was sort of not, it was missing in a patch. And it's dark, it's so dark. And I was using a torch on these little lanes, you know, there's no lights. And I set it all up. And, you know, it looks like a weapon. Like, I realised that once I saw
your
it walking
telescope.
Over. I never thought about it like that. But actually, then I looked at it. And I thought, actually, this looks like, oh no, what did they think? And they were shining this torch in my eyes. And they had this big 4x4 and they came over, you know, what are you doing? But I was so excited because I'd just seen Saturn that I just started jumping up and down. I was like, you have to look through the telescope at Saturn. And so straight away they sort of clocked what was happening and they were looking through the telescope. And the farmer said to me, I always come out here to check on the cows at night, but I never look up, but I will now, you know. We had a really nice conversation.
So what that strikes me about you, Zion, is that you are an amazing communicator. You don't mind being threatened with getting off the land.
It was quite threatening.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh,
but he also shook my hand and he said, come back. He? Yeah, genuinely. He said, but I mean, I'll never go back because I don't know where it is. It's the middle of nowhere. It was just the middle of nowhere. I was just looking for a patch to find. You know, a lot of these lanes are not even on any maps. I just found somewhere. So thank you to that farmer. But, you know, he really shook my hand. Anytime you want to use my land, which is just really, you know, heartwarming for me. And I hope that it is because I'm a good communicator.
And listening and working both ways and hearing that side to things. Do you think you are a very brave person? Do you think you are out there? Do you find sometimes that you think, oh my goodness, I've got to do this, but actually I know that I'm so passionate about this and I believe in it so strongly, as well as having the scientific backup as well. But you need to be brave, do you not, to do this?
I think so. I get called brave a lot, so I guess so. I don't feel particularly brave. You know, I just saw this morning that there are three activists in Extinction Rebellion Scotland who've just climbed. They've just gone out on a boat and climbed the Shell Rig. Did you see that? They're staying up there in this weather. And in Scotland, it's cold. And I saw that and was like, whoa, massive respect to them. That is brave. That is not something that I would be able to do, you know. But then who knows, maybe they look at me and say, she went on the Andrew Neil show, because I get that quite a lot. Even now, it was ages ago, but it had like 2 million views. So even now I'll get that and I'll get recognised. You did that thing, and they think it's really brave. But I'm just sitting down talking to another human being. It doesn't scare me. Why would it scare me?
Well, that's true. But if we talk about reactions, and because in 2015, you produced that book, which is The Ultimate Guide to Green Parenting. That was 2015. Mm. And in one of the tabloid newspapers, it was a fantastic article. It was absolutely wonderful. And then if you go further down in 2018, in the same tabloid newspaper, you are quoted as being clueless on the Andrew Neil show. The question I ask is, you've got to be quite strong and thick-skinned, haven't you? Because you can go from being the angel and then suddenly you are this person who gets a negative criticism.
Oh, absolutely.
And do you learn along the way to actually sort of box that, put it away and get on to the next
part? Honestly, I just think I'm such a resilient person. I kind of just don't care. And same thing that I had when I was at school, where I just didn't care if I was the weirdo who was collecting all the little bits of paper in the corner to recycle, because I knew that it was better for the planet and I was doing it to help everybody, and that's all that mattered to me, and it's the same thing that matters. And on that note, I had Michael Schellenberger recently wrote an article about me. The title was Why Everything They Say About the Climate Movement Is Wrong, and it had a picture of me, Bill McKibben, Greta Thunberg and AOC, and a koala, which I thought was kind of funny because I was a bit like, what did the koala say?
Yeah.
But the article was, and actually if you read the article, it's quite heavily criticising mostly me. But I didn't even know that was out. You know, somebody sent it to me and said, have you seen this, Zion? You know, I don't follow what's going on. And I said, oh, that's interesting, because actually I read some of Michael's work and I actually think I would get on with him in real life. So I sent him a message and I said, do you really think... So he said in that article that I was wrong about mass migration. And I sent him some articles, science-based research, and I said, is this wrong, Michael? Because that's what you've said. And he said, let's have a phone chat about it. And I spoke to him on the phone, it's only a couple of weeks ago. So I arranged it and I spoke to him on the phone. We got on really well. And he said he was really happy speaking with me, and he said he's writing a book and he'll use some of my quotes. And he said, can I quote you as XR? And I said, where I've spoken about these things, yes, you can. These things here are my opinion. And that was it. And now occasionally he'll ping me an article and I'll send him a reply email and we get on really well. So that was a really interesting turnaround. If you look at that article, you think, wow, this guy really hates this woman that he's never met.
But that's great that you did that, because that's the sort of thing that I would expect from you. You're very good at communicating and being diplomatic about it. But for him, he's written that article, it's out there, continues to be out there.
It does, yes.
Did he actually say, I was wrong to have put that in? No.
No.
So why does he do that?
You know, it's not.
Okay.
It's not online, is it?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Again, if people read it and that's what they believe, then they're making their own assumptions, and I can't change that. But I'm always here to, you know, people tweet me and email me.
Extinction Rebellion are obviously pushing the movement and making sure we're very aware of climate change and all the issues that come with that as well. All these protests that are happening, you see some negativity in the press where two men were trying to stop a tube very recently and they got pulled down. So as much as getting bad press, do you think that all the protests and the movement that you do, do you think that's making a positive impact on our own conscience?
Mm. So the first thing I would say is that I'm always amazed at how popular we are, given that all we do is cause trouble. All we do is cause disruption. That's our entire aim, is to disrupt the system and to call for a better system. It says in our Declaration of Rebellion that we are not a protest movement, we are in open rebellion against the British government. I'm amazed that people like us as much as they do. You know, my email is just going every day, can you come and speak at this? Can you write, I've had it this morning, can you write this article for me? Can you tweet this for me? You know, all day, and that's outside of the work I do within the organisation that's XR, which there is so much happening. And I do the newspaper, so I get all the feedback from that. I mean, I'm amazed, you know, that there isn't more of a reaction like at Canning Town. And actually, yeah, you know, Canning Town, I had my own thoughts about that. And
that's Canning Town, the tube, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I'm really good friends with Mark. He's an incredible person. And again, anybody who meets Mark loves him. And he's really, you know, he's very centered. He meditates a lot, really beautiful person. And his intentions were pure, you know.
You get that impression about
him. And
the
he was very sorry afterwards, he was. And he said, maybe, you know, he doesn't live in London, maybe he should have thought about the area or whatever. But there's always, I say, there's always that potential for anything, any event like that to go wrong. And we try really hard to make sure anyone who comes into the movement does the non-violent direct action training where that's covered. And you have that understanding of, even if someone comes at you, you stay non-violent. First of all, massive, important principle. It's more than just a tick box. Like, you really have to be centered in this. Don't do the action if you think that you're going to lash out, because people might respond badly towards you. But just remember why you're doing it, and if your intentions are pure, then that's all anyone can do, really. And no one's forcing anyone to do anything, of course. Yeah, the suffragettes were really unpopular.
I was just about to ask you that.
So, I mean, you know, I just think, again, like, why are we so popular? I get asked all the time to come and do this, and come to people who've never met me, you know, and I just think, even with all those articles saying that I'm clueless. And
so the Hourglass newspaper, what exactly is the purpose of the Hourglass newspaper? And when did it start?
The purpose is to have a model of climate reporting. What would it look like if the newspapers responded to the climate emergency the way that they responded to war? And I actually studied this. I went back and I looked at the war reporting. So every bit of the paper would become about the war situation. Even the recipe page would become about how to feed your family with rations. Every little bit of it. So I thought, how do we apply this to a newspaper? And I looked at all the newspapers and I said, you know, they might have a little section on environment. They might even go a bit all out and then have a whole page on climate reporting, but it's actually, the whole paper needs to look like this. What does that look like? And that's what the model is, and that's what we introduced to the press when we had a press conference before the last rebellion, which I introduced. I said, you know, I've left you all an Hourglass on your seats. It was, you know, room full of journalists. It's just think of the Morrow Boys. I don't know if you know anything about the Morrow Boys. There were, there's actually a group of men and a woman, but they were called the Morrow Boys because two of the men leading it had the surname Morrow. And they were groundbreaking journalists during World War II, where they were told by the editors not to report on the war. They're told, people don't want to hear about that, and they went and did it anyway. They risked their jobs. But once they did, the interest in it became so great, people realised what was happening, that they wanted to be involved, basically. Not that I'm, you know, a warmonger person, but that it influenced people because... And actually, it's not... It did influence people, but it wasn't propaganda. All they did was tell people the truth. Mm. And so there's an aspect of that now, where, and I've said that to that room of journalists, what does it mean for you to tell the truth? I'm not saying put your job on the line, but, you know, a lot of us are putting our liberty on the line when we get arrested. You know, what will you put on the line when you really understand that this is like a war-type mobilisation we need?
What do you think MPs and companies and most people, you know, countries, what are they afraid of about climate change? Because there seems to be, you've just talked about World War II and how patriotism was the way of bringing everyone together. So it wasn't a case of telling the truth, it was a case of telling, this is what we need to do to win the war. Mm. Now, in many ways, it is a war in the sense that you're trying to win over climate change, and you're trying to make sure that we are so very aware of it on a personal and group point of view. But why are we so afraid of it?
This is a really interesting topic and something that I've read quite widely on, and a lot of what it seems to come down to, I mean, obviously different people might have different reasons, but overall it's kind of an existential crisis that almost evolutionarily we're not wired to imagine a threat that is just so huge and philosophical, and also, by the way, we're the enemy. You know, we're very good at pointing out at the end, what happens when it's all of you and it's your loved ones and it's where you live and it's things that you enjoy and you didn't mean to hurt anyone. It's really hard, I think. And actually, it takes so much courage. The thing what you were saying earlier about being brave. Look at the people who do speak out about this, like Greta. You have to be brave because you have to take your head out of the sand and own it, and you have to look it in the face, and you have to look at awful things like that baby kangaroo burned to cinders, you know, trying to escape through that. And no one wants to look at it, and I don't even blame anyone. Why would anyone want to look at that? It's heartbreaking, and you especially don't want to think that A, you did anything to contribute that to that, and B, that you're it makes you feel helpless. You know, it makes you feel awful. So no wonder people look away. But the problem, of course, is looking away will make it worse.
What would be the advice to all the young people out there? You've talked about that it's their issue. It's our issue, as you say, as well. How would you advise someone not to be, not upset, but to use their energy of anger and move forward from an individual point of view?
I think it's like holding hands with a loved one. And they're slipping away, and you know there is medicine, and you know if you work really hard, you might get medicine and save that person. You know, I think humans are incredible, and we can achieve incredible things where we really want to, and that we have to remember that and hold to that. That actually, when people are well looked after, and you know they don't have all the struggles that actually people face today, they're great to each other. You know, and we don't have to be. There's no reason for us to be. We could be tribal warriors all the time. It's in our DNA, but we choose acts of kindness.
But are there some things you think, crikey, we've done it there? Are there little bits in this chink or this puzzle? Or, yeah, I suppose it is a puzzle in many ways that we're trying to bring everybody together. But are there things that have come along you thought, wow, that has made a difference?
There are lots of things happening all around the world that are inspiring and incredible, and it's people behind those things. It's generally not governments, although there have been cases of, was it the Netherlands, where they made public transport free.
That's right.
Germany dropping their public transport prices. There's always stuff like that, and it's really worth remembering that actually that's just people pushing for those changes, and that's incredible. But the most incredible thing for me is the way that these protest movements have brought people together in a way that I just could not have foreseen, and I'm grateful for every day, because I was fighting this fight on my own for so long. And
what do you mean by on your own? Do you mean
trying to get people to recycle when I'm 8.
Yes.
And trying to sign a petition at school about, can we make sure the school turns the lights off at night, you know, at the age of 12. And then 15, oh, she's a bit weird. Why doesn't she eat meat? She just has to have salad when the rest of us are having burgers. Why won't she just eat it? Why don't you just eat it, Zion? Look, it's really cheap. We're in KFC. Why don't you eat here? It's the coming together for me, which is the most positive thing, because who knows what that could build.
Well, exactly. And just touching on planes and travel, I think recently you put out a quota in 2025 that we want to halt plane travel. Is that right? I mean, how realistic do you like to be on your views and quotes?
So the important thing is we only have three demands, and that's the thing. Those are the things that we're all behind. Tell the truth, net zero by 2025, and citizens' assemblies. All the other stuff is just speculation. We don't have any official lines on it because we don't believe that we should be dictators and we should decide that. All we're saying is listen to the experts. What Greta's saying, you know, why listen to us when you can go and listen to experts who studied aviation? You know, there's people who studied this stuff their whole lives who will tell you what sustainable levels are and how to go about it. And maybe it does mean that industry has to die, or maybe it can evolve and change. Maybe there are better fuels. Honestly, I wouldn't claim to know. I don't want to spend a week researching it when somebody out there already knows. With citizen assemblies, we're saying, let's get those experts in a room, let's get people in a room, like a jury, you listen to the evidence and let people decide once they hear the evidence. Because actually the politicians are very bad at listening to evidence. I would stand behind whatever the experts say if they say we need to bring down flights by this much, or if they don't, if they say we need a certain kind of, you know, replacement for fossil fuels, absolutely, fine. That's what we're saying, is we need to move in that direction, which is slowly starting to happen. Over half of the councils in the UK have now set up citizens' assemblies. So I feel like that is happening. It's just everything does feel slow when you're up against the behemoth that is the climate and ecological crisis.
Oh, it's been great talking to you,
Zion Lights. Thank
you. It's been fantastic indeed. And just when you want to switch off at the end of the day, what is your switch off moment?
You really want to know?
Yeah, of course we do.
I'm a massive geek.
Yeah, that's good.
I love all fantasy, Lord of the Rings, I read the books every year, watch the films. Cosplay, I do cosplay. Anime, I watch anime with my kids. So somebody changed my Wikipedia page. They vandalised it. It gets vandalised all the time. I think they've locked it down now. But somebody changed my name on there to Poison Ivy. Obviously meant as like an attack. No, but it was great because then I dressed up as Poison Ivy for Halloween. I was like, yes, thank you, trolls. It gave me a great idea. That's basically what I do. And just remember to laugh at things.
Well, I think you've been an absolute inspiration.
Thank you
so much indeed.
That was Zeon Lights talking to Susie Thorpe.
So when I went to Longlander to speak and interview Zeon Lights, I entered into the Extinction Rebellion building. It's very white, very modern, and they have quite a few rooms off. They use quite a few meeting rooms. But it was a really interesting building because everybody in there was very laid back. They'd all say thank you or they'd say hi to you, but everybody was really friendly. Now, I'm sure in most offices, everyone's really friendly, but it just seemed a little bit more, I don't know, just more relaxed, and they wanted to speak to everybody that came in, and there was no sort of put your head down, get on with the work. They were very networky, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Didn't even occur to me they had a building, to be quite honest, because they always come across, obviously they're quite well organised and coordinated, it always comes across to me as a collective of people who just kind of get together to do things.
Yeah, sort of meet up in the street.
Yes, exactly. Didn't even occur to me that they would have an HQ and be running things.
Yeah, they do. They had a lot of nice people there and they were really friendly, as I said. She got a great press, obviously, in the Daily Telegraph in 2015 when it came out. And I asked her about the TEDx talks as well, because I really enjoyed watching the TEDx talks. Good for her. And we wish her all the best. And
indeed.
What an amazing thing to be involved in.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Venture capital is Anya Novitsky's dream job. She is founding partner at Voulet Capital, Europe's first venture capital fund for female founders. Anya has been recognised as one of the most notable women and a catalyst hero by thenextwoman.com. Susie Thorpe spoke to Anya about her work.
Anya Novitsky is the founding partner of Voulet Capital, Europe's first venture capital firm investing in female founders. Anya is an investor in residence at Google for Startups and runs monthly pitch clinics for female founders and has been featured in many publications, including the Financial Times. She has also been recognised as one of the most notable women and a catalyst hero by thenextwomen.com. That is quite an achievement. Anya says venture capital is her dream job.
Well, it took me 20 years to figure that out, funnily enough. But, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm not really an investor. And I keep saying to people, I keep walking around and pretending to be a VC. Because I love building businesses. That's what I've been doing for the last 15, 20 years. And I finally found a job where I get to build help build multiple businesses all at the same time. It's perfect time for me.
Anya recently had a baby and was committed to work in venture capital at the same time too. She wanted to breastfeed. So big job plus becoming a mother means making life as efficient as possible. Anya realised there was not a particular good breast pump on the market.
Absolutely. Until LV have launched theirs just a few months ago, which was unfortunately too late for my child and for me, breast pumps haven't really changed in decades. And it's funny, I was recently doing a diagram for somebody and I literally showed a broken down diagram of one of the top brands. Thing came in 22 different pieces and it's supposed to be a portable model that you're supposed to be using out and about. I think any mother who has ever gone through this process knows that 22 individual pieces that need to be washed after every single use, which is noisy and painful, is not a suitable contraption.
Finding the right breast pump was the easy part. But it wasn't getting the attention needed to make women's lives easier in the working sphere.
I found one that was launched in the US, and it was just a whole reimagined approach to breast pump. Some publication called it the iPhone of breast pumps, and I fully agree. With it, unfortunately, came the story, the horrific story of the founder who had major issues raising money. She was badly treated by investors. In fact, it was covered by The New Yorker and Bloomberg in the end because the story was so horrible. She had kind of the worst set of experiences of all of us put together. And it was incredibly disappointing because investors did not understand the product, did not understand the market, did not understand her as a female founder. And thankfully, since then, the market has moved forward quite a lot. But the fact that LV still remains the largest femtech funding round and it's at $40 million tells you how far we still have to go. Some of the other tech rounds, which are in hundreds of millions, you suddenly understand that this area has been massively underinvested into for us.
Anya explains her role as investor in residence at Google for Startups in London.
This role came in almost like as a result of a symbiotic relationship we have with Google. You know, we started off as a very young VC. We had very few resources when we first got going. We still have very few resources because we plow them into our companies as much as we can. And Google was, at least Google for Startups, was going through this transformation. They obviously have the resources to dedicate to the ecosystem in London. Originally, when the campus was launched, this was the core of the new London kind of infrastructure for startups. Since then, over the last decade, the whole ecosystem in London has evolved, and therefore the role of the campus has changed. So what they tried to do is use those resources to help the right kinds of startups and also the right kinds of investors. So for us, it's a symbiotic relationship. So I mentor residents of the cafe here downstairs as part of my role. I run investor in residence kind of office hours at least once a month. And in exchange, we get certain resources such as being able to be based here, which is fantastic and obviously a huge cost saving for us, but also gets us closer to some amazing companies. And we also run our events here together with Google. So one of them being our monthly pitch clinic for female founders, which again gives us access to a space that's perfectly suited for it and an infrastructure for other things that we already also have in the pipeline, because it's a family-friendly building, for example, which allows babies and children and caters for that possibility. So it seems like a natural partnership for us.
Raising awareness of women founders and promoting diversity, I asked Anya if we have reached a tipping point for women founders and entrepreneurs.
It's an interesting question, and I say that because obviously there's been a lot of discussion around investment in women over the last couple of years. But very sadly, the numbers are actually declining since 2016. Despite a lot of my colleagues walking around saying they're going to invest in women, the results are just not there. The recent numbers from Atomico's report on the state of the industry show yet another decline. And part of it, I think, is because people think that if they're doing all these pitching competitions and office hours, that that's enough. But the fundamental structure of the industry has to change if we genuinely want to make a difference. Terms and how we do business have to change. And for us, that's been a key realization. When I came into the space, I was a novice. I figured it out as I went along. You know, a typical entrepreneur, it was kind of like, oh, well, I'll work it out. Now, a year and a half since we launched, I have clarity over what does or doesn't work. And it's a bit of a wake-up call for some of my colleagues when we say to them, for example, that we take ordinary shares, that we don't do prefs, we don't do ratchets, we focus on value, not valuations. Over the last 20 years or so, terms and financial instruments being used by investors have become more and more complex. A typical term sheet can sometimes be 60-something pages long. It includes instruments that founders don't understand because they're so complex. Most VCs I know take preferred shares, for example, which most founders don't really understand. They don't realize that those shares entitle an investor to a larger portion of the upside if something goes wrong, but also if something goes right. For example, preferred shares typically kick in when there's a liquidation event. So most founders think, oh, well, that's when things go wrong. And then investors try to claw back the value. But unfortunately, things like a sale of a business also classifies as a liquidation event. So founders get caught in these instruments that they don't fully get and they don't see full implications of. And actually, investors get a disproportional share of the return while carrying less of the risk. In some cases, we've seen term sheet, we walked away from a deal with two other investors recently where if you've done the mathematical calculations of the payouts using the formula being proposed by investors, you would never get an agreement between founders and investors on the sale of a business, because investors had a direct incentive to sell the business for an even lower price, at which point they would get a higher return, and the founders would lose a big chunk of their upside. So those kinds of things don't work. And actually what I found is that women don't want to go down that route. They're clear about the kind of culture and approach to their business that they want to create, and they're looking for a real partner in their investor, which I think is a really positive and constructive thing and a very confident thing to do. And those types of behaviors don't match the businesses they're trying to build. So if industry wants to invest in women, I think they need to seriously look at how they're investing in general.
How we perceive women founders. Now, is there a big divide still between men and women?
I think there is. And I think culture is a very important word. You know, it drives a lot of things within an organization. You know, a lot of us read Zappos' kind of book and we understand the impact it has on the face and direction of the business, on how employees perceive their jobs, how committed they are, how long they stay. And actually, women have been shown to build businesses that are much more flexible, much more open, much more diverse. And actually, from a society point of view, that's great, but also from a business point of view, that's great. So breaking down some of those entrenched kind of more corporate attitudes would definitely help. So I think it's not a matter of fitting women into the finance industry as it stands, it's more adapting it so that it's inclusive of everybody.
Networking now, is it still deemed to be the best way forward to finding your next investor, your next partner for your startup? Is networking good for women? Are women confident or strong enough, or are they just put off by this whole process?
It's interesting. I don't think it's a strength issue. I think it's just when you walk into a room full of men, you feel on the back foot no matter who you are. To give you an example, kind of a flip example, when we held our launch event for the International Women's Day a couple of years ago, it was a room full of women, obviously. There were four exceptions. Four guys in the room, all connected to us in some shape or form, some through investors, some was a co-investor. And one of those co-investors, he had a daughter just the month before. And after the event, he came up to me and said, "Hey, now I know what you girls feel like when you walk into a room full of us. It's not comfortable. And it's certainly not a friendly environment. Because if people don't look like us when we walk in, we naturally feel it's a very kind of primal response. So it's not even just about individuals' confidence. It's built in, it's hardwired. So we need to change the composition of those rooms."
I really wanted to know if Anya was going to change or wanted to change the culture of networking. Anya doesn't always rely on networking. People obviously approach Anya to pitch. But does network need to upgrade, change really, to accommodate women with families?
For us at least, obviously I can't speak for other VCs, but we, for example, don't go to pitching days. Because I don't think pitches work as a tool, as an instrument. I don't think they highlight the best deals, and they certainly don't give me the right information to make a decision. We make it very easy for people to apply to us. You can go straight onto the website, send us a deck, and we will take a look at it. Yes, we do get referrals. Of course, other investors send us stuff. Our very first investment was a referral from another family office. It was too early stage for them. But actually, all it did at the time was make me go and have a meeting with the guys. And I would do that for any other venture if I see a deck that I really like, or even just an idea that I really like. So I think it's being open to sourcing transactions from as wide a range of sources as possible. And that's where a lot of VCs struggle, because then their pipeline tends to be incredibly narrow. It comes from the same small group of sources. And that needs to break. That needs to change. And we need to make it easy for people to send a deck or a summary. for VC to be able to have a quick look and say, actually, this might be interesting or it might not be.
Both Anya and I have read the book Invisible Women. It's by Caroline Criado Perez, and the book is about exposing the data bias in a world designed for men.
Caroline's done an amazing job doing the research to put it all together. What it has given me, or someone like me, is ammunition. I was recently in front of a room, on a panel in front of a room full of men. It was a family offices summit, naturally full of men. And we were in this diversity, typical diversity panel right at the end of the event. And it allowed me to connect with those men on the level, because they walked into a room thinking, well, we live in a meritocracy, everyone has a chance. But being able to talk to them in the sense, like, for example, I asked them, you know, how many people drive? How many people in the room have a car? And of course, everyone's hands shut up, and they're all men, they love cars. But then being able to explain to them that if they're driving home from a restaurant and their wife is driving and they get into an accident, they have a kind of 10 to 15% chance of a serious injury or death. Turning that around and being the next day when they're taking their daughter to school, suddenly that risk can go up to as much as 40%. That actually made every single man stand up and lean forward. That's kind of engagement that we need. I think that's what Caroline's work has given us, the real tangible examples that we can put in front of these people. You know, in tech space, I can talk to them about voice recognition software. And again, people think that, well, okay, so it doesn't work as well for women. It's a bit of a, you know, an issue with Alexa or whatever it might be. But when you apply that to medicine, when you apply that to surgeons dictating notes about their patients, where mistakes can cost very dearly, when you apply that to cars, when you're in an accident and you need to call emergency services, suddenly that becomes a life and death situation. And increasingly we're relying on those technologies, we're relying on algorithms which are biased and which are also private. So most of us don't even understand how biased they are because they're all proprietary information. So suddenly awareness of those issues become very critical. Like, for example, we don't invest in HR kind of digital solutions because I can't trust that those algorithms will not be biased.
From interviews we have completed on Women Making Waves, there are moments when we've heard that women have to pit against each other.
I think it's an age-old issue because you either get women collaborating or you get women really competing. But historically, women get penalized for supporting other women within organizations. We've seen that on performance reviews. We've seen that within the VC industry, where if partners, female partners, promote other women and really kind of take them under their wings, they get penalized as a result. We've seen that within large corporates. And that needs to change. And I'm not sure how we change that, because obviously men don't get penalized for for supporting other white men. But somehow that needs to shift before women feel comfortable and open in doing so. Diversity is about, to get value from diversity, you have to make everyone feel included. You have to create an organization, culture, and environment where anyone can really kind of plug in and feel comfortable. And that's something that's sometimes not easy to do. It's something that I'm certainly mindful of as we grow as a team, but also within our portfolio companies and between our portfolio companies. And I was very pleased. We had for the first time in September, we had a dinner for all of our founders. There was about 15 people in the room across five different companies. And you've had everything from 20-year-olds to 50-year-olds. You had about 12 different nationalities, completely different backgrounds, and they all got on. There was this tribe atmosphere, you know, and between them day to day, they exchange ideas, they exchange information and resources. And to me, that's what I want to build. And that's when real value happens.
I asked Anya if she thought there is a gender bias towards women receiving a lot more criticism in business than men.
I think women are judged more harshly all the way through succeeding. And it is difficult to shift that whole idea that a woman has to be twice as good as a man. It's still present. And yes, when someone really successful as a woman fails, she does get a lot more criticism as a result. But I think slowly that's shifting. I think the more we start to accept failure in entrepreneurship as a constructive thing, up to a point,
obviously.
You know, in Europe, we just don't have that failure culture that you have in the Silicon Valley. In the Valley, you could have, you know, quite a few VCs would not even look at you if you haven't tried at least a couple of businesses. They almost feel like, well, go make some mistakes and then come back. I remember when I was interviewed for a job here in the UK, this was like 12 years ago. I was setting up my very first business. It was a social impact incubator. And I was also at the same time interviewing for this impact, quite a senior job to run a kind of a UK division of one of the biggest impact organizations in the world. And I remember after the interview, they told me, go do the incubator, fail, and then come back. And it really stunned at the time, because I was really young and I felt, hang on a second, I'm good enough now. But I now know what they meant. The experience that I've had over the years of being in different businesses, of seeing them succeed and some fail, of kind of going through all these different situations, has been incredibly valuable. It means I can avoid so many issues now, and I have a very much broader and deeper perspective on things.
When it comes to gaining success through the experience of failure, Anya clearly thinks the US have a head start and that Europe is still playing catch up.
I think we're a younger kind of entrepreneurial ecosystem than the US. It yeah. takes us a while to catch up to where they are. You know, if we keep in mind that the VC industry in the US was born after the Second World War, and actually, in many ways, you could argue George Doria created it during the Second World War. It's the only reason they could mask the resources to support Europe during the war. That was the dry run. How do you leverage ideas and get them to market as quickly as possible? That was kind of the beginnings of it. In Europe, we're very much behind. 10 years ago, when Seedcamp was being formed, people kept saying, well, there is no entrepreneurship in Europe. It doesn't have entrepreneurial spirit. Now, obviously, we all know that it does. But it's taken the last decade from people like Reshma Sahoni, for example, to really build on that and prove those people wrong.
Now, there are always challenges too.
Launching a venture capital fund and having a kid at the same time as a single parent, that first year was hard, let's put it this way. And it is doable, it's perfectly possible, and I really admire women who make it work, but it's been a lot of blood, sweat and tears, and it's a lonely journey when you're trying to figure out two complete different things at the same time, and you're constantly pulled in multiple directions. The number of evening events that happen for work are horrendous. The number of times I have to tell people, you're trying to do a diversity event at 7 in the evening, how are you going to attract women in their 30s? That you're putting more pressure on them when they already have a long day, and then they have to go home and pick up their kids from school and deal with all the kind of household stuff. I think all of those pressures are difficult. I agree with Scandinavians who are much clearer about these boundaries between work and personal life. There has to be balance. That culture of being in the office or being at work until 9, 10, 11, multiple times a week, I don't think it's constructive. I don't think it makes us as productive as we could be. I certainly do shorter hours than some of my colleagues because I have to be home for 5 o'clock, 5 till 7 is my daughter's time. After she's in bed, I go back on email quite often or on the phone and finish things. I don't do emails on weekends unless it's an emergency with one of my portfolio companies, which happens quite rarely. But, you know, it's a boundary I had to put in place. And some people took a while to adjust to that. But it's doable. I think it hasn't made me any less determined or effective at what I do.
Now, there is always time, according to Anya, to re-energise away from the office.
I genuinely enjoy spending time with my daughter. She's going through that period of changing every single day and learning new things. And it's just shifted my own perspective on the world, and seeing her view has been incredibly energizing. But obviously, as you know, a lot of parents with young children, they don't get a lot of me time. You get little moments when you can. I read a lot. I love reading on the train or whenever I get a few moments here and there. I love photography. I love dinners with close friends, and I love traveling, and I very much continue to make room for it.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, thank you so much indeed, Anya Nowitzki. It's been so lovely having you here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Anya Nowitzki talking to Susie Thorpe.
Interesting talking to Anya Nowitzki there, Linda, because lots of things, obviously, that were in that interview that we talked about. But one of the things that came out, I think it is quite important, was the part of networking. She is really, really against now networking at weekends and in the evenings mm-hmm. because she has a child.
Mm-hmm. It's very difficult.
Yeah. I know networking as something that you do in the evening when you mm-hmm. have finished work.
With a glass of wine yeah. and someone's talking, or it's just a pure networking event. And it always is after work. That's when they happen. Very tricky.
And she's representing women, isn't yes. she? I mean, her view on this is all from a women's perspective.
Yeah.
And if she's trying to bring in more female founders and more investors, that was a very big part, I thought, that we've got to change that.
But I mean, how can you change it? Because really, people are not going to want to stop in the middle of the afternoon to go and meet up with peers. That's the thing. There have been some networking events that have been happening at breakfast, which might be better, but you still got to drop your kid off at school or at a childminder or wait for a nanny to arrive or something, you know. So,
but it should be really, I suppose, just part of your working day, even if the children are at school and do after clubs.
There's usually not time, though. Just usually not time. It's a very, very tricky one.
It is a tricky one, yeah. Well, that's one to remember. So we hope you enjoyed it. That's all we have time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd like to thank our guests, Zeon Lights and Anya Nowitzki. Now, if you know of a woman who is making waves, we'd like to speak to her.
You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also catch up with our programmes on cambridge105.co.uk, and you can visit our website womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.